Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Your Absence is Darkness by John Kallman Stephenson. John Kallman Stephenson's 2007 novel, Heaven and Hell, the first of an extraordinary trilogy, begins with a sea voyage worthy of Melville. A crew of cod fishermen is caught in a storm off a remote coast of Iceland. The land vanishes, snow swirls over the water. As the waves bear down on the soaked rowers, they must stop continually to punch off the ice that forms on their clothes. It's a fitting image of both the sea's terrifying indifference and a desperate, seemingly futile, violence from within. Elemental nature and human tragedy are equally present in Stephenson's latest book to be translated into English, Your Absence is Darkness. Set across farms and villages on the wind and sea-swept Snæfells Peninsula in western Iceland, the novel presents communities similarly shaped by their harsh and beautiful landscape and by the rich history of their forebears. The novel begins, however, with a blank canvas. The narrator awakes with amnesia inside a church, knowing neither his name nor how he arrived. He is not alone. There is a stranger in a back pew who makes him uneasy, and he flees outside, where he meets a woman amid the gravestones of the churchyard. The woman clearly knows him. She is delighted by his presence and offers to take him to her sister, with whom, she implies, the narrator once was close. First, though, she brings him to the grave of her mother, where she tells a story of her parents' love. It is but a premonition of the storytelling to come. When at last they reach the woman's sister, the narrator experiences the first of many convulsive recollections that he sets down on any scrap of paper he can find. Most of Your Absence is Darkness consists of these writings, which come to the narrator in fugues, as if I'd received a powerful electric shock that unleashed a flurry of vague thoughts and unfathomable feelings within me. Some are prompted by the mysterious stranger from the church, a shapeshifter who reappears as a coach driver, switches clothing faster than a quick change artist, and, among other quirks, offers guidance while preparing crepes. The characters and stories are as varied as they are vivid. There is Gudrider, a modest peasant's wife, who pens a philosophical article on the earthworm. Peter, a lovelorn priest who writes letters to the dead poet Friedrich Hölderlin. John, tormented by alcoholism and yet bewitched by the stars in the sky. And in the most contemporary story, the musician Eriker, who is abandoned as a boy by his mother and is adrift in Europe until a family crisis prompts him to return home. Each story could stand on its own. One of the pleasures of the novel is the slow revelation of their connections. This is a tale of heritage, a topic hardly unique to Iceland, and yet it is impossible not to feel that it shares many of the same preoccupations, genealogical and topographical, with classic 13th and 14th century Icelandic family sagas. Indeed, I often found myself thinking of the family trees and coastal maps in my copy of The Saga of Icelanders, just as I often thought of the epic, compassionate, and humorous lens that Halldór Laxness, Iceland's only Nobel laureate in literature, turned upon the struggles of humble farmers in Independent People, a lodestone for any writer of rural life. Yet such comparisons do not do justice to the complexity of Stephenson's book, nor the uniqueness of his prose, rendered here in a tumblingly beautiful translation by Philip Roughton. The structure of Your Absence is Darkness is best described as a series of recursions. The stories build and break apart, yield to other stories, emerge again later, sometimes at length, sometimes in fragments, flashbacks, single words. The effect is kaleidoscopic. As the narrative turns, pieces shift, stories merge, themes dilate and contract. I fantasized about an edition printed in color, each narrative strand a hue of its own, the shuttling, shuffling syntax fractal in its effect. Or perhaps the better comparison would be musical. Around, voices entering at different intervals, bringing elements of both melody and harmony. The text quotes itself constantly, tying centuries and generations together into one unbroken whole in a way that feels fruitless to quote. A late paragraph of exquisite beauty made almost no sense when I tried to include it here because it builds on over 400 pages that must be read first. Music also appears in more direct ways in the novel. Regular mention is made of specific songs and artists, from Icelandic classics and Edith Piaf to Bob Dylan and Amy Winehouse, all compiled in a Death's playlist at the back of the book, and, I've since learned, in a Spotify playlist. I don't know what kind of effect listening to it would have had while reading, but my suspicion is that Stephenson's unique voice, his stunning imagery, and his expansive, sympathetic score of human experience are all music enough. Many artists have made use of amnesia for narrative purposes, whether it's biographical rediscovery in Christopher Nolan's film Memento, or the more philosophical exploration of self in Tom McCarthy's novel Remainder. From early on, however, Stephenson makes it clear that he is after something different. In linking remembering to recreation, he uses amnesia to bring author and reader together as common travelers into the unknown. For what are we upon opening a new book, if not amnesiac? We must have our new lives created for us. Either it must be explicitly explained, or we must piece together clues, must eavesdrop. We too appear in the courtyard without memory and meet the world anew. This review was written by Daniel Mason. He is the author, most recently, of the novel Northwoods. Grief is for People by Sloane Crosley. Sloane Crosley opens her new book, Grief is for People, with an explanation. Container first, emotion second. It's a four-word guide for the reader. Relieve yourself of the need to understand and open your mind to the experience of death, suicide, and the emotional debris found when you consider the ultimate inevitability. Grief is for People is Crosley's eighth book, counting the novel she co-wrote under a pen name and the anthology she edited, and her first memoir. In it, she ties together two losses she suffered in 2019. The first, the theft of a collection of jewelry, including a beloved green cocktail ring that Crosley inherited from her grandmother, which was stolen when Crosley's home was burglarized one afternoon. Threaded with it is the death of Crosley's close friend, mentor, and former boss, Russell Perrault, who worked for years as the executive director of publicity and social media for Penguin Random House's Vintage Books imprint. He took his own life just 1 month after Crosley's home was broken into, and the close timing of both events intertwines them emotionally for her, ultimately altering the experience of both losses in her memory and hindering her ability to process either. The memoir is divided into five sections that allude to Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief: denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and afterward, instead of acceptance. In each section, Crosley dissects her memories for missed warning signs, lamenting her inability to predict what and who would soon be gone from her life. In the depression, anger, and bargaining sections, she anxiously considers if this was the moment that changed everything, or maybe it was that one. She wonders if there was a right question she could have asked Perrault, something to say that would have rescued him from his fate. Perrault was a robust and complicated figure. He was a friend and mentor to Crosley, yes, but as Crosley recounts, he also faced a series of complaints about his conduct inside the workplace and was confronting a host of other unknowns to the author and to us. After his death, Crosley wants to know much more about him. She interrogates every interaction from their time together, especially those nearest to the tragedy. She wonders about the lack of invitations to his home in upstate New York, which, it turns out, Perrault had begun filling with more and more objects. He wasn't a hoarder per se, but he was engaging in a land grab for the past, for souvenirs of a more contented time. A vein of tension in Crosley's memoir is the desire to hold the memory of Perrault close while trying to anticipate what life will be without him. Without his living voice present, she's left to sift through their old text messages and wonder where everything I loved has gone and why. The book is less than 200 pages, but the weight of suicide as a subject paired with Crosley's exceptional ability to write juicy conversation prevents it from being the kind of slim volume one flies through and forgets. Her signature shrewdness comes through particularly in the depression section, which shows the author in the depths of her grief, but offers relief through humorous lines of dialogue and passing thoughts on pandemic-era activities. We were not depressed all the time. No, sometimes we were drunk. Though humor can feel downright medicinal in a time of grief, it has its limits. There are moments when the memoir reveals this, when Crosley is confronted by the reality that a joke is not a sustainable way of processing her pain, or at least, like most cheap hits of dopamine, its effects degrade over time. In Afterward, she comes to understand this realization could have been Perrault's ultimate desire for her. Maybe he wanted her to know that at some point, you have to face the feral emotion you've been locking in a cage and distracting with a funny bone. You have to face your life and your dead so that you may live. Looking into the past to answer thorny questions while mourning may lead us to interesting places, but it won't lead us to the voices of the dead, just as hunting for lost or taken objects won't always return them to our hands. Death's wall of silence is impermeable. Our memories are what we have left, and there's no amount of remembering that will give us back what we seek. Time does not heal all wounds, Crosley writes. Time does not heal any wounds. Instead, time only pushes wounds aside. Perrault is gone, as is the world he thrived in, so where does that leave Crosley? Here, offering us a look into his life through the lens of her love, pain, and admiration. Telling us with precision and generosity how it might be when it is our turn to remember what was true about those we've lost. This review was written by Ashley C. Ford, who is the author of Somebody's Daughter. Headshot by Rita Bullwinkle. It takes focus and discipline and a certain single-mindedness to become a good prize fighter. It takes those same qualities to write a book as fresh and strong and sinuous as Headshot, Rita Bullwinkle's first novel, which is set in the world of young women's boxing. To put this another way, make room, American fiction, for a meaningful new voice. The young women in Headshot have driven a long way, many of them, to Reno for a national 18 and under championship. Some have slept in their cars. The novel follows 8 of these boxers, fight by fight, from the semifinals on, in chapters divided into short sections. The event is at Bob's Boxing Palace, a grandiose name for a cheerless warehouse. Its ring looks second-hand, as if it were bartered for on Craigslist, the author writes. To remark that Bullwinkle is observant about Reno and its casinos would be an understatement. The people are like moths being lured to their own deaths, but instead of death, all that awaits them are large, plastic, alcoholic slurpees, she writes, an oddly incisive description of the American experience writ large. She is just as shrewd about the second-rate referees, one of whom resembles a hated magistrate, trying to give a speech to the masses during a time of war. Whatever she turns her attention to glows under her scrutiny. A tournament bracket turned on its side, Bullwinkle notices, resembles a family tree, though almost none of these boxers are related. Some are still girls, really, but without straining, the author locates commonalities. Few are from stable families. They are flowers that bloomed in muddy vases. Several were the kind of children who were made to believe by other children that they may not deserve to be alive. They have something to prove, even if only here in the abyss of boxing. These women revel in their toned bodies, radiant with heat. A black eye is likened to war paint. A vein slithers like a baby snake under the skin. A left hook to the side makes sweat pop like a shower of diamonds. This is kinetic writing, but it would mean little without this novel's undertow of human feeling and the rapt attention it pays to life's bottom dogs, young women who are short on sophistication but long on motivation. The tournament bracket provides this novel's scaffolding, each chapter a bout. We witness the boxers' different styles and their variegated interior monologues. One mutters and grunts through her fights, the way Errol Garner did under his piano riffs. Others walk in with all guns blazing. One fight is like watching two people talking where one person is doing all of the mouth work, and only every once in a while the other person interjects. In this description, Bullwinkle is in sync with A.J. Liebling, who saw that boxing is a dialogue. An infelicitous line invokes a disastrous rhyme. Boxing is a pulverizing sort of waltz. You pair up with your opponents as if they were Bluetooth devices, and then do everything you can to disconnect them. The essential otherness of one's fellow humans is deeply felt. Boxing can be sexual this way. Bullwinkle is the author of a book of stories, Belly Up, which only hinted at the power on display here, though it too contained some boxing writing. She was recently named editor of McSweeney's Quarterly. The writing in that determinedly whimsical publication has been known to cloy. There is no whimsy in Headshot. Instead, there is astringency. One sign of this book's power is that its drama does not accrue from questions of who will win or lose. This is not a Rocky narrative, though it is hard not to think of Rocky when considering a narrative from a writer named Bullwinkle. The drama is intense but interior. We are inside a torrid milieu of perception. This novel is about how intoxicating it is to play a sport that requires one to look in their opponent's eyes. It is about pride and control and the way a fighter's blood and her salty tears and slick sweat make it look like she is leaking pink Kool-Aid from her nostrils. It's about the joy of violence, joy in the unambiguous event. Amid the chaos, there is control, Bullwinkle writes. There is a glorification in the world outside of boxing, of desperation and wildness while fighting. This notion that desire and scrappiness can and will conquer experience. No boxing coach has ever asked their athlete to be more desperate. What are these young women fighting for? Even they are uncertain. Women's boxing will never be something respected enough to put every ounce of your energy into, one fighter thinks. Another fighter, a dilettante from Seattle who gets into boxing because it sounds quirky and cool, has her mother say to her, "Only vulgar girls become the best in the world at boxing." In Sonny Liston Was a Friend of Mine, his 1999 story collection, Tom Jones wrote that the thing that makes you good in the ring is the very thing that makes life outside the gym impossible. Bullwinkle is agnostic on this point. To lose a match might feel like a verdict on your whole life, but she fast-forwards and gives us glimpses of these young women decades later, when they are pharmacists or grocery store managers. The word college rarely appears in this book. For most, boxing left little impact, except for long-ago broken fingers that can still ache. The impact of this novel, though, lasts a long time, like a sharp fist to your shoulder. It is so enveloping to read that you feel, at times, that you are writing it in your own mind. It contains no bogus psychologizing. Its wide-awake characters put me in mind of the singer Ian Drury's immortal comment, "I'm not here to be remembered. I'm here to be alive." This review was written by Dwight Garner. He has been the book critic for The Times since 2008 and before that was an editor at the Book Review for a decade. Neighbors and Other Stories by Diane Oliver. Plowshares, Granta, Mademoiselle, Yes, Children. Before it stopped publishing fiction in 1992, this sadly defunct glossy magazine was, between the lipstick ads, a deep and shimmering American literary oasis. Mademoiselle, pronounced Millie around the office, like the dependable farm girl she was, showcased the short stories of James Baldwin, Truman Capote, Barbara Kingsolver, and a ballroom's worth of other award-winning writers. It ran a summer guest editor program for college students whose alumni included Joan Didion, Ann Beatty, and most famously, because of the novel The Bell Jar, with its memorable scene of ptomaine poisoning after a luncheon of avocado stuffed with crab meat, Sylvia Plath. Also, Diane Oliver, whose death at 22 after a motorcycle accident was even more premature than Plath's. She will be eternally Mademoiselle. Born in 1943 to school teachers in Charlotte, North Carolina, Oliver, who was black, attended segregated schools, university in Greensboro, and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She lived to see four of her stories published, including in the Sewanee Review and Negro Digest. A new collection, Neighbors and Other Stories, gathers these with 10 more and an introduction by Tayari Jones, the author of An American Marriage. At a moment when short stories seem less regular launch pads for long careers than occasional meteors, reading these is like finding hunks of gold bullion buried in your backyard. Oliver's primary topic, she didn't have enough time on this earth to develop many, was the private bulwark of the family, during a time when Jim Crow separate but equal laws still ruled the South. In the title story, which was posthumously awarded the O. Henry Prize in 1967, a mother, father, and sister agonize over a young boy who, if they can stomach subjecting him to the experience, will be single-handedly integrating his elementary school in the morning. Police cruisers haunt their house. In the closet on the top floor, a student named Winifred realizes she is tired of being the experiment as she settles uneasily into a white college, deciding to major in history because drama would mean playing the maid's part for 4 years, and biology might require field trips and testing how motels will receive her. Sublimating the stress and ringed by mean girl white roommates, she begins hiding desserts and then herself. Such luminous simplicity is deceptive. These stories detail basic routines of getting through difficult days, but then often deliver a massive wallop. Mint Julep's Not Served Here, wherein a patronizing social worker visits a reclusive black family in the woods to check on their son Rabbit, who's gone mute after being bullied, has a hilarious horror movie twist. The succinct No Brown Sugar in Anybody's Milk, which the Paris Review ran last year, is a clever folding screen of fantasy, nightmare, and tiring reality. Neighbors and Other Stories is not wholly polished. How could it be? The experimental Frozen Voices whirls around and around confusingly, repetitively. Something about an affair? A plane crash? I never said goodbye, the narrator intones again and again. Jet Magazine was one of the few periodicals to say goodbye to Diane Oliver with an obituary. Thanks to this collection, the New York Times now belatedly bids a full-throated hello. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs. She is a Times book critic and occasional feature writer. She joined the Times in 2010. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.